Hi, everyone. My name is Beverly Douglas, and I am an alcoholic. And very proud to stand here before you tonight and tell you that I'm a sober woman alcoholic, because that certainly wasn't the case for a long time. I, too, want to thank the committee. And I've got to tell you, my husband and I, when he was alive, and I still do a lot of speaking around, and our committee here has been just absolutely fabulous. And I don't just say that to flatter them or you, that you have such a good committee, but it's true. And they've kept in touch and kept us informed all the way along, and it's been wonderful. And, I also wanted to thank Dick, who has the tape library, because it's through these tapes that our message is carried on to the people that are shut-ins and can't get to conventions like this and meetings. And they have become very important in our way of life. Somebody said to me when I first gave my full name at a podium, you're not supposed to identify your last name. Well, that's fine, but that means, outside of AA. And I'll tell you why I do it in AA. I had a new baby, and she was about 18 months sober when she came to me. And her name was Joy. And one evening, my husband and I had some AA friends over, and we were all sitting around yakking like we all do, and carrying on. And we got a phone call, and it was from a friend of this new baby of mine, Joy. And she had had a heart attack and was in the hospital, and she wanted me to be there with her. She was very frightened. They had just put her in. And so they said that she was at this hospital, certain hospital, and we all went charging over, in two cars, the whole gang, how we are. And we went into the lobby there, and there was an information desk over on the right, and my husband walked over there, and all of a sudden he realized he didn't know her last name. And so he said to the information girl, he said, "Do you have a Joy here?" And the woman looked up at him, and she kind of grinned, and she says, "Well, sometimes we do, and sometimes we don't." I got to think about that. I thought, I've got to learn people's last names. You never know. It's very hard to look us up in a telephone book, if you don't know the last name of the person. First names just don't count in telephone books. I didn't identify myself by my full name in AA, but not outside of AA. I like to talk about the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And for some of the new people that are here, and especially for our little newcomers that have come in, joined us, we hope you stay. And it's very difficult when we're alcoholic to think of life without alcohol. And then when I'm going to talk about myself, and I'm going to talk about the things that I've had to learn in order for me to stay sober. What you have to do is what you have to do, and it may be different from what I've had to do. The thing of it is that I don't want to be preaching. I want you to know I'm not here. Hell, I can't even manage my own life, let alone try to manage yours, But yet we try to do this, don't we? Can't manage your own, but I'm very happy to help you with yours. There is a part of this book that my husband used to open up quite a few of his talks with, and because I didn't understand the language when I got here. I didn't know what the heck you were talking about. It was like you had a whole new language that I'd never even heard of before. So this is the part that stood out for me and that he used so much when he would open his talks, and it's in the back of the big book right after the spiritual experience. And it says, "There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all argument, which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. And that principle is contempt prior to investigation." So what I'm really saying is stay around long enough to learn the language and to really find out what this program is all about. Because if you're an alcoholic, certainly Alcoholics Anonymous is not the only way for all of us. But it has been the best way, and the only way that I have ever found. And I tried churches, and I tried all the things that we tried, and the most fun I had was trying out different husbands to stay sober. So if it sounds like I have another little problem in there, I do, and I'll talk about that later on. And also, I get very excited the more I get into the book and what I've had to learn and how it's applied in my life. The more I start talking a strange language to some people, and I tell you, I'm from the South, and that begins to come out after a while. And I had somebody come up to me and ask me later where I was from, and I said, well, originally I'm from Florida. And they said, oh, we thought you said you come from the South. Well, I don't know how damn far south you can get, But I just loved it when Blanche was talking, and she said she was from Florida. And I thought, oh, my God, I didn't know that. I got to talk to that woman about home. I didn't come in here willingly. And it's been mentioned a couple times at this convention, what Clancy has said. And I used to like to say, this is what I heard him say, because I used to hear things that people didn't say. You identify with that? If you ever had a baby that you were sitting in a meeting, or even a strange person would be in a meeting where you were, and they'd say, and they didn't know who you were, but they'd say, now Beverly said, and they'd say something I'd never even thought of saying or didn't even know anything about, So I always like to say, well, I thought he said. But evidently he must have said it, because I've heard it repeated twice here in the meeting. And I usually don't use his name. I just say there was a man over the hill from me, But God knows he needs all the advertising he can get. But what I used to think I heard him say was, today I no longer have a drinking problem. Today I have a living problem. Well, let me tell you something. Everybody on this earth has a living problem. And you don't have to be an alcoholic, and you don't have to be drunk or sober to have a living problem. We all do. But I come into Alcoholics Anonymous because I was dying from alcohol. I was literally dying from alcohol. And the day that this girl ever forgets that alcohol is my number one problem and always will be is the day I'm liable to be back out there on the juice again. And I don't want that to ever happen. So I have to keep it up front for me that alcohol to me will kill me, and that everybody has living problems. Yes, our book does teach us, the things to do when we run up against these problems. But I don't know if that's the main purpose of the book, because to me the main purpose of what the 12 steps are about is to take us in to seek out this power greater than ourselves. And another thing that I heard, that I'm not sure that the person said, was, well, you can work this program any way you want to. Well, now, I had been told that the steps were listed by number in an order, and they were to be applied that way. And here I'm hearing somebody say, well, you can work it any way you want to. So I used to be terrified I was going to get drunk again, that I simply was not going to, I was going to be one of those that was too mentally and emotionally ill to make it. Because I got here after spending 6 months in a nut house. I don't baby it up. I mean, I was in the crazy loony bin, they said that I was there because I was having epileptic seizures and that I was manic depressive. Most amazing thing has happened to me since I got here to you people. I have stopped having those epileptic seizures, and I'm no longer manic depressive. Now I do get depressed, occasionally, but I know what I'm depressed about. And I'm not manic with it. In fact, I take to isolation when I get depressed, but I've learned to give myself just so much time. I give myself a limit when I start getting depressed. I called up this sponsor because I was so afraid I was going to get drunk if I didn't do it right. You know, there was a right way, and I had been told that, and I had to do it right, and I didn't know what this person was talking about. He said you could work it any way you want to when I was told it had to be worked in order. And, you know, I had the kind of sponsor that says, thou shall have no other gods before me. I've still got one just exactly like that. And she gave me 2 minutes to tell her what my problem was on the telephone or in person. It didn't matter. So I immediately called her up, and I had learned to talk real fast because you got to talk fast to get it all in 2 minutes. And then she would stop me when I think she had a stopwatch or something that she kept by the telephone. And she would stop, and she would give me this. Honey, read your book. The answers are in the book. Have you ever had your sponsor do that? You just want to let them have it, you know. But, you know, I thought that woman was really stupid, you know, because you're newcomers and you ever get a sponsor like that, let me tell you why they tell you that. They know the answers in the book. They just don't know where in the hell it is in the book. You know, and it took me about 5 or 6 years to realize that this woman was really not that stupid. She had me reading this book over and over and over and over again. And she also had taught me to use a dictionary with it. Now, the first thing I heard when I got to AA was buy a big book. So I bought the big book, and I brought it home, and I gave it the place of honor right in the middle of the living room in the center of the coffee table. Then the next thing I heard was get a sponsor, and I did. I got me, you know. And then the next thing I heard was get pamphlets, take them home, and read them. So I got pamphlets, and I brought them home, and I read them, and I placed them all around my big book there in the center of the coffee table in the living room, you know, right in front of God and everybody. And, I was so proud that I was staying sober. You know, God, I'd been sober about 5 or 6 days. And, I was just, so was my daughter, too, by the way. She was 14 when I sobered up. But anyway, and then I'd go to meetings and I'd get more pamphlets and I'd read them and I'd place them on the end tables of the couch, on each end of the couch. And I got more pamphlets and I read them and I placed them on the nightstand in the bedroom on his side of the bed. He's still out there. But I'm not with him anymore. But anyway, and then my sponsor called me. The first thing she told me, she said, honey, she was downright insulting. She said, honey, if by mistake somebody should call on you to share in a meeting, she said, you stand up and you give them your name and you state your illness, and then you sit down and you shut up and you listen because, honey, that's all you know. I mean, she was mean. Anyway, she called me up this day, which was unusual for her to call me, and she says, I'm coming over to talk to you. And she told me when. Well, I knew that when she came, I was to sit down, shut up, and listen, you know. So I had gotten that part right off the bat. So the next thing, you know, she comes in, and she plumps her little butt down in the center of that couch right where that coffee table is, where my big book is. And she looked at it, and she looked down at me, and she reached over, and she picked it up, and she wiped the dust off of it. And she had handed it to me, and she says, now here, honey, read it. Now, nobody had said read it. They just said buy it, you know. So anyway, that was when I started reading this book. Now, I don't know about you, but when I got here, I'd read the book, and I'd get through one sentence, and I'd forgotten what it said, but I was there shaking my head. But I couldn't remember what it said, but I knew it was right, you know, because I identified with it. But anyway, so I started reading this book. And another thing that she had said to me, she said, honey, she said, there are certain meetings that I want you to go to. And she named off like a book study meeting and a problem participation meeting and a question and answer meeting, and she says, now you can choose any of those that you choose to go to, but those are the types of meetings that I want you to go to every week. And then she did it, and she said, and I want you to go to a woman's stag meeting. I said, I beg your pardon. She said, a woman's stag meeting. I turned around and looked at her, and I said, there is no way in hell I'm going into those PTA meetings with those gossiping, backstabbing bitches. You see, I didn't care very much for women at that time. I'd had a couple of husbands who were in bed with my best girlfriends. And, you know, and I really didn't care a lot about women. But she looked over at me and she said, honey, let me tell you something. She said, you look like a woman and you dress like one. And occasionally you talk like one. But she said, I don't think you really know what it is to be a woman, and you will go to those meetings. So she came by. There was one the next day, and she came by and picked me up. I think she thought I wasn't going to mind her, you know, so she was going to make sure that I went. And we went into that PTA meeting. And sure as heck, I found some gossiping, backstabbing bitches. They're in here. They really are. But let me tell you what else I found. I found some very warm, wonderful women who literally saved my life. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. Now, we all know that you gentlemen will help us with our spiritual program. But I would suggest that you get a good, firm, basic program under your belt first, because you're going to need it, believe me. Anyway, so I'm in these PTA meetings now, and it's one of my home groups. And Then I thought, well, you know, now where do I go? What do I do? Because I'm nervous now, because I'm going on a year sober, and I'm just riding on your coattails, really, just staying sober and trying to read the book but not remembering anything. And so I know it's, in fact, my sponsor told me it was time to get down to business. And I didn't know exactly what to do, but I figured I better get in this book and start learning something. Now, you see, I don't believe that alcoholics do things right or wrong. I think they just do them a little backwards sometimes. And as proof of that, I don't know how y'all are here, but, you know, the cakes, whether they're round or oblong or whatever they are, when we give out birthday cakes at home, what would happen, and I don't care how many years the person had on the program, they would put all the candles on the outside and then always put a few in the middle to make it difficult to blow out. Well, when they would go to light them, they would light the outside of the candles first, then burn the hell out of their hands lighting the inside. Now, that's a little bit backwards from what normal people do things, you know. And I got to thinking about that, because you men kept saying, well, you women are always talking off of your emotions. And, you know, and I said, well, how do you apply your life? Well, we're very logical. Well, let me tell you, if you gentlemen were so logical, now stop and think about this, you would be the ones riding side saddle, not us women. Hurts me just to think about it. Anyway, you're thinking about it. You're catching it. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so I got into this book. Now, in the back part of the book there, where I read that little quote from Spencer about open-mindedness, right up above that, it says there are three essentials, and that's honesty, willingness, and open-mindedness. Now, I like to talk about principles, values, and morals, and I like to group them together because these were things that I knew about. You know, I love that little book that says everything we've ever needed to know we learned in Sunday school, you know, because I did. I knew right from wrong most of the time, but it didn't matter when I was drinking. And it did the first one, maybe, you know, the second one, you know, who cared? You know, let's have fun. But anyway, so this is how I applied things to my life. And as I told you, you know, I do things a little bit backwards. If you could have seen me try to get dressed tonight and Doris trying to help me, you know that I've done things backwards. Everything I have done today, I mean, it's just been a backward day all day. But anyway, so being alcoholic, I'm going to start with the 12th step, okay? And it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the results of these steps, We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. And God knows we have a lot of them. Fun. Well, enough of that one. So let me start back at the beginning, okay? In that first step, where it talks about, you know, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I got a principle out of that. There's two parts to that step. And the principle was, is when I was honestly able to admit that I was truly an alcoholic, not just by raising my hand because I was told to, or somebody nudged me and said, get your hand up there, you know, but because I had learned what alcoholism was. You see, when I first came into AA in 65, Alcoholics Anonymous was anonymous. And, you know, you didn't hear that much about it. And I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I thought it was the town drunk, you know. I didn't realize I was one of the town drunks. When I could honestly able to admit that I was truly an alcoholic, deep down in my gut and in my heart, you know, for some reason I was able to set aside the juice. And to this day, I've never had to pick up a drink. Now, I don't know what tomorrow holds, because I was told there was no guarantees on this program. But that if we did certain things and followed certain guidelines, that the chances were that I would stay sober today. And that's all I had, was just one day at a time. And I thought, God, I can do that one. You know, it was the only way I could stay sober. And that's the way I did it. I mean, I did it one day at a time. I was one of those that was just hanging on by the fingernails because I wanted to drink so bad I couldn't hardly stand it. But anyway, the most amazing thing happened, as I said, you know, once I got sober, I was no longer having those things. But those seizures and manic depression, and I forgot to put this in there. You know, I forget what I'm talking about half the time, so if you'll forgive me if I, you know, jump from one thing to another. I try to keep a little continuity in it, but occasionally I lose it. But if alcohol will induce these same symptoms, so exact that even doctors and psychiatrists many times cannot differentiate the difference, it will also cover up these things. And I believe that that's the reason the book says, you know, if you have been sober for a while and you find, you know, that you are still having problems along these lines, for God's sake, get into a psychiatrist or a doctor. Don't come to us and ask us what you should do, because we're liable to tell you. And, you know, and you're liable to die behind that. Because there's a lot of us that will play doctor or counselor or psychiatrist or something, you know. With the people coming into AA Day, you know, I want to talk a minute about singleness of purpose, too. You know, we have one purpose in here, one purpose. And that is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. That is our only purpose in here. Stay sober ourselves. And the way we do that is through using these guidelines in our lives. Suggested steps. I love that. Suggested. But there's a lot of must in behind there. And, of course, we don't like those words, but there's a lot of them in there. And I have found for me it was necessary to follow these musts, not guidelines and suggestions. Anyway, so the second part of the first step is that my life was unmanageable. Well, you know, I have worked with a lot of people who use that as a cop-out. You know, they go ahead and they do what they want to do, and then they come running back to me saying, well, what can I do? And usually it's a man. You know, well, what can I do? And I said, well, you know, why didn't you come to me before you got involved in this? Well, after all, I'm only an alcoholic and my life is unmanageable. You know, I just want to punch him one. You know, I don't know about you, but my life when I was out there was unmanageable because I was drinking so damn much. The most amazing thing happened once I got here to you people and stopped drinking. My life has become a lot more manageable. One of the main reasons it has is because I've gotten a new director, you know. And I've gotten some guidelines in my life, you know, and that's God first in my life. Then me. and then those around me in the order of importance to me. Now, I thought that I had originated that, and I was talking about it in meetings, you know, and I thought I had really learned something real smart. And we have a lot of tapes at home, and I was playing some tapes one afternoon, and this guy on this tape had said something very similar to that. And I called my husband in. I said, "You listen to this man." I said, "He's heard me speak somewhere, and he's using my talk." It was Father John Doe. I couldn't believe it. But anyway, so what I've learned is that I haven't originated anything. I haven't originated nothing. So anyway, I have gotten my first principle in Alcoholics Anonymous, the principle of honesty, out of the first step. I'm an alcoholic. And when I learned I was an alcoholic, and as I said, when I could honestly admit it, I have never had to pick up a drink to this day. I don't know what tomorrow brings. I don't know what caused me to pick up a drink. I have certainly been close to it several times. I've had a bottle right up to my mouth. And a woman called me that I had met for the first time the night before. And I think this is what they mean by Eskimos. I have a home group, and it's called the Canyon Participation Meeting, Chatsworth Canyon Participating Meeting. And there was a woman that came into that meeting on Thursday. And she had never been there before. I had never seen her anywhere in AA. And I had mentioned something as I was sharing that we were leaving the next day to go to San Francisco, partly on business, and from there we were going on vacation. And she said, "I'll be in San Francisco tomorrow." We weren't going to leave until, I think it was Saturday morning. And she said, "Where are you going to be staying at? I'll call you and we'll get together and go to an AA meeting." And I told her we were going to be at the St. Francis. So anyway, my daughter had an appendicitis attack that night and was burning up with fever and was terribly ill. And I called the house doctor, and the whole thing ended up that we got her over to a hospital, and they wanted to do emergency surgery on her. Her appendix was ready to burst, and I couldn't find my husband. He was off somewhere with somebody. He had a habit of doing that. He told me he was supposed to be working, and he wasn't at work when I tried to find him. But anyway, I had come back from the hospital not knowing what to do, terrified for my daughter. And everybody has their booze sitting on these, you know, dressers, and, you know, and they have these big mirrors there, and they have all the setups and everything. And my husband was still drinking at the time there. And this was my third husband that I'm talking about now. Okay, so anyway, I walked over to that, and I didn't know what to do, and I was terrified, and I automatically reached over and picked up that bottle, and I had unscrewed the top off of it and had it up to my mouth, looking at myself in the mirror, saying, "What am I going to tell these girls back at Sober Sal's?" And because I knew I was going, you know, I was getting ready to drink. And the telephone rang, and it was this woman that had been at the Thursday night Canyon meeting. She called me. And she said, "Beverly, you're upset. What's the matter?" And I told her. And she said, "I know exactly where the hospital is. I'm just two blocks from there." She said, "Grab a cab and come on over and I'll meet you there." She was there waiting for me when I got there. I didn't drink. So to me, that's what an Eskimo means. And I've had twice that's happened in my sobriety. But anyway, now I'm ready to go into the second step. And in that second step, it said, came to believe that a power greater than ourself could restore us to sanity. Now, what does that mean? You know, what kind of sanity are they talking about? Because, hell, I knew I was insane. I had a gift certificate from UCLA saying I'd been in the nut house there for 6 months, you know, so I had no problem with that. But according to what this book says, that's not exactly what they're talking about. They're talking about the insanity of the thinking preceding that first drink. The thinking preceding that first drink is the insanity that they're talking about for the alcoholic. And you see, that's what I had had when I was in San Francisco. I felt all alone. I felt abandoned. I was scared to death. And I'd always used alcohol to relieve the tension, the worry, the whatever was happening in my life, to take away the fear and the pain. And so Sanity. Restore me to sanity. There was two parts to that, and that was the mental obsession and the allergy of the body. Because in there it says that that our main problem centers in our minds. The main problem. And that is the thinking. That is the insanity of the second step. And in that second step, what it's trying to teach us there is to keep an open mind. To keep an open mind. And that was very difficult for me to do because what I could see coming was this word, you know, and it was called spiritual way of life. Well, to me, that meant religion. And I had tried religion, and religion did not work for me. I had tried just about every kind of church that I could think of, and it just did not help me to stay sober. I couldn't stay sober in behind that. And beside that, I'd had enough time to look around these rooms, and there was too many of these Catholic priests, pardon me, Father, you know, and ministers of the other cloth, and these little nunny bunnies were running around in here like crazy, you know. So I knew religion wasn't going to work, and yet they kept talking about spirituality. And then I looked it up in the dictionary, because my sponsor told me to. And what I found in there that helped me to keep an open mind was it says, being spiritual is simply an elevation of thought and feeling. God, wasn't that simple? And I could buy that. I could buy that. Because the minute I set aside the juice, I automatically had an elevation of thought and feeling. It wasn't anything I had to think about or work on or know even about. It just happened. I remember after I'd been sober for a few weeks or months or however long it was a short period of time, I had sliding glass doors from my living room out into my backyard. And I remember, excuse me, opening up these doors and walking out early in the morning with my cup of coffee to sit on the patio. And it was like there was a whole new world out there. And I thought, God, you know, where have I been all my life? You know, it was just that dynamic for me. Just momentarily. You know, it was, God, it was like, where have I been all my life? You know, what I forgot to do was tell you how I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think that was important to me. And, of course, I'm doing everything cockeyed tonight here. But I was in my home, and it's the same home that I live in today there in Chatsworth. And my daughter was away visiting friends on the weekend. And the husband, the third one that I was married to at that time, he was about 5 or 6 hours late getting home from work. And, hell, we women all know where you guys are when you're 5 or 6 hours late getting home from work, don't we, honey? You bet we do. You're out with her, right? The one who understands them. You know, don't sit back there and laugh, honey, because some of us were the ones who understood them. You betcha. And anyway, I had been waiting because he was supposed to take me out to dinner that night. And so I was trying not to drink too much. And anyway, after about 5 or 6 hours, here he come. Well, hell, it's 11:30 at night, you know, and I'd had a few. And he walked over and he looked down at me and he said, you're drunk and I'm not going to take you anywhere. And with that, he went on up into the bedroom and passed out. Now, I was a little ticked off, you know, and so I poured myself another drink. And I remember walking from the rumpus room, there was just a couple little steps up into my kitchen area. And my kitchen faces the front of my house. And I looked out in the driveway, and there were two brand-new cars sitting in that driveway. And I walked through my home, you know, and it was a brand-new home at that time. And it was beautifully, beautifully furnished. In fact, it had been done by an interior decorator. The furniture came from Sloan's over in Beverly Hills. And, you know, and I'm not saying that to brag, and I'll tell you why I'm telling you this in just a second here. And I remember walking on out into the backyard, and it was it was beautifully landscaped, too, because that was all, you know, in the home there, and very well manicured, you know. And if you could have opened up the book of the Better Homes and Gardens, you would have seen a home similar to mine in that book. And that's what my daughter and my husband and I presented out there to the world. We were this family that belonged in this yard, that belonged in this home, that belonged in the book of the Better Homes and Gardens. And yet, as I stood there that night, I remember looking up and crying out and saying, why God, why now, when I've got everything that I have always wanted? Why do I want to die? You know, and I couldn't have told you that night. But tonight I can. You see, I know. Good is all you've got. All those material things. If there is no joy in them. And you see, alcohol had taken all of the joy out of my life. It had taken me into a living hell of which I could find no way out of. I think that Christ said something like that when he said, "What profits a man who gains the world and then loses his very soul?" And you see, that's what had happened to me. Alcohol had taken my very soul. And I remember walking on down into the rumpus room and fixing myself another drink. What the hell else do, you know, when you're feeling that low? And I sat there and I looked at that glass of booze in my hand. And I knew if I kept on drinking, I was going to die. But, you know, also at that very same moment, I knew if I quit drinking, I'd die. Well, what do you do when you can't drink anymore and you can't drink any less? I did the only thing I knew to do. I killed myself that night. Now, I say that facetiously. And yet, for me, I believe it to be a truth because this book talks about a rebirth. And you see, I believe that that night was the night of my conception, of my rebirth. I started to say I woke up. Hell no, Alky ever wakes up. I came to. Okay, when I came to, I had these tubes out my nose, my throat, both arms, and both ankles. And what is the first question, and especially a woman will ask when she comes to the next morning? Where am I? You know, and it's very difficult to talk over these hoses down your throat, you know, and stuff. And you can't move too well, and I'm just laying there like this, you know, and I'm saying out loud, "Where am I?" And this voice, because it was dark, said, "You're in County General Hospital." Well, next question, how did I get in County General Hospital? I live in Chatsworth. We have money. We have medical insurance. Why am I in a county? I was insulted. I wasn't either glad that I was dead or alive. I was just insulted. And this voice walked over to me, and it was a policeman. And he looked down at me. People were always looking down at me for some reason. I never understood it. And anyway, and he said, "Lady," he said, "committing suicide is against the law." Well, now, hell, I didn't know that, or I might not have done it, you know. But anyway, I was telling this story at one of the speaker meetings there at home, and this nice young gentleman came over to me after the meeting, and he said, "Beverly," he said, "you gave a wonderful talk, but," he said, "you made one little mistake." He said, "Well, would you mind if I corrected you on it?" And I said, "No, Don, not at all." And he happened to know about the law because he was sitting on the appellate court after his sobriety. And he said, "Honey," he said, "committing suicide is not against the law." He said, "It's attempting suicide that's against the law." Well, now, when I thought about it, that made more sense, you know. But anyway, it was through this that, because when I'd gotten out of the nut house, they had recommended this psychiatrist that I go to, and I'd been going to him for 3.5 years. And I'd been going to him as many as 3 times a week, you know, at $60 a visit. That was a cut rate. That was a special rate. But I was only getting 40 minutes, too. I wasn't even getting 50. And he sent word that he wanted me to come straight up to his office as soon as I was released. And I got up there, and he looked over at me, and he said, "Beverly," he said, "you need help, and you need it desperately." And he said, "I can't help you. Here's the number of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I was kind of ticked. I'm trying not to cuss. My sponsor doesn't like cussing, and she's sitting here, so I have to be careful. And anyway, I'll tell you why I was ticked. Now, I had been going to this man for 3.5 years, almost drinking myself to death, you know, during that 3.5 years. Paying him $60 a visit, as many as 3 times a week. And almost killed myself, and he had the nerve to sit there and tell me after all that he couldn't help me. I mean, you know, I was mad. But I never said anything. You know, I held everything inside and shoved it or pushed it or stored it or whatever they call it. But anyway, I didn't say anything, and I took the number, and when I got home, I called. And these women came out to my house. You know, the woman that answered the phone in the central office, she said to me, she didn't ask me if I was an alcoholic, and I'm very grateful she didn't, because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I did know that I kept getting in trouble every time I drank, which was all the time. And it had gotten to the point where once I'd take a drink, I would go on a binge. And I would go as long as my body could take it. And sometimes it would be as much as 3 weeks. And I would find myself laying in bed with my bottle in the bed with me. And a 14-year-old daughter didn't like that very much. I remember her walking in one day and looking down at me real disgusted because I had run out of booze. And I'd ask her to go back into the rumpus room and get a bottle for me out of the bar. You see, my mother and I owned a liquor store. God, it was so helpful. My mother was an alcoholic too, but she didn't get here until after I did, but she had 5 years of sobriety. In fact, this is my mama's book, and I carry it with me wherever I go, because I know she wants to be a part of this even now. You know, I carry my book with me. You know, when I was drinking, I always had a bottle. Somewhere I had a bottle, in my purse or in the car or the trunk or someplace, you know, because if I didn't have my bottle, I'd get struck sober, and God forbid, I couldn't stand that, you know. So I always carry my book because I'm afraid if I don't, I'll always get struck drunk, you know, and that's just a superstition with me, so it doesn't mean anything to you. But anyway, so there I am, and I get home, and I call this central office, and the lady says to me over the phone, she didn't ask me if I was an alcoholic, she said, "Honey, do you have a drinking problem?" I said, "Lady, I sure do." And she said, "Well, are you drinking right now?" And I remember looking around, and I didn't see anything sitting close by, and I said, "Well, no, I don't think so, not right at the moment." And, well, I was getting thirsty. I'd been out of that hospital for 5 hours. And I'm sure that you guys understand that, you know, when you've been let out of jail, where's the first, and some of you women have been in jail too, I'm sure, on DUIs and stuff, you know, where they put you occasionally. And the first place you head is to a liquor store or a bar, you know, and I was no different. You know, I was out of that hospital 5 hours, and I was thirsty as I could be. And she said, "Well, can you hold off for a little while? I'd like to send some people out to talk to you." And I said, "Well, I'll try." And and I also told her she'd make it quick because I needed something. And so anyway, these two women came to my house, and they were there for almost 2 hours. Well, while I was waiting for them to get there, I was thinking of what I was going to tell them. I was going to tell them all about that son of a gun. Is that one all right? I didn't say son of a what, you know. I knew when I told him, you know, how he was treating me and what he was doing, that they would understand why I had to drink like I did, because I'd been married to two of them already, and three of them, actually. But the other one, that's another story by itself. But anyway, they came to my house. They were there for almost 2 hours. Every time I would try to tell them something about him or me or what was going on, you know, they turn around and start talking to each other. I never got to tell them anything. All they did was sit there and talk to each other about what they were like and what happened to them. You know, you talk about selfish and self-centered. They were it. And finally they got up to leave, and they got up the door, and they turned around and looked at me as if I was some kind of an afterthought. And they said, "You be dressed, honey, and ready to go at 8 o'clock. We're going to come by and take you to a meeting." They never even asked me if I wanted to go. Anyway, I was dressed. They came and we went. And that was my introduction into Alcoholics Anonymous, now that I'm on my second step. Okay, so out of the second step, if you can catch up with me here, I learned the principle. Remember, in the first step, I learned the principle of honesty. And in that second step, I learned the principle of open-mindedness, because it said it's vitally important that you keep an open mind. And as I said, you know, by realizing, you know, and looking up in the dictionary what spirituality was, because I kept connecting it to religion, it was simply an elevation of thought and feeling. And that automatically happened when I quit drinking. So now I've got two of the three essentials that the book talks about. And then I went into my third step, you know, there I was. And there's that word, God. And we're back to religion again. And I can't buy it. I'm really having a terrible time with it. And they said, "Well, your God can be anything you want it to be." And I said, "Well, I don't understand that." I said, "I've been taught God is God." But I didn't think he wanted anything to do with the likes of me because I knew what I had done was wrong. It wasn't if I'd made a mistake, you know, I knew going in. And I didn't think he'd want to have anything to do with somebody like me. And this open-mindedness, you know, I had to remember that I was supposed to keep an open mind. And I tell you what shoved me in to keeping an open mind. I remembered something that I had either read or heard when I was a child, and it went something like this. And it was God talking. I had read it in the Bible. I remembered that. And it was in red, and anything I had been taught that was in red was God talking, and or Jesus. And I hope I don't offend anybody, because some people take resentment when I use those two words. But anyway, it says, I have created man in my image, and for man I have made woman, created woman. And woman is to follow man. And I thought, well, now I've done that. I followed three of them. Look where I ended up at, the Nut House and Alcoholics Anonymous. Something was wrong somewhere. I got ahead of myself on that one, okay? Just erase that one for right now. I'll get back to it. What I remembered on this particular occasion was that there was something somebody had said to me one time, and it was that I would... How in the heck did that go? I would rather die... Misty, I would rather die and find out that there was a God. I've forgotten it. My mind went. Okay. Anyway, it was something that scared me. Okay. They say that alcoholics won't stay sober on fear. Let me tell you, this girl stayed sober on fear for a long, long time. And, you know, it was one of the God-given things that God gave us, and He gave it to us for a good reason. It's according to how we use things that makes the difference. Because there's always a flip side to everything. And if He created all things, He created fear too. And if I use it in the right way, it works well for me. And I was like the jaywalker, you know, that kept constantly walking out there in front of the cars and the traffic and stuff. And so this boosted me into keeping this open mind, and I was willing then to take the third step. Now, in the first two steps, it called them cornerstone, which is the very basics, the very foundation that our program is built on. And in the third step, it called it a keystone. And I didn't know what a keystone was, so back to the dictionary I go. Now, I've already got my three basic principles now. I've got honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, the three essentials. I can't, He can, so let Him, you know. And so in that third step, it says, this is the step in which we're going to walk through the archway of freedom. Freedom from the bondage of self. Freedom from the bondage of this thing up here that drives us and takes us right back into the drinking, the insanity preceding that first drink. And so anyway, I envision this archway. And in the dictionary, what it said was, it's that main mortar that starts off that archway to freedom. And that the first two steps, our cornerstones, our basic, are connected to that third step. And every step thereafter in our program is connected to that third step. And if that third step is not firmly in place in my life, when everything seems to fall apart and go to heck, you know, if that step is not firmly in place, you know, the chances are good that I'll drink. So to me, that third step is vital, absolutely vital. And I had a lot of trouble with it, and it took me a long time to finally accept a new Creator. And it says that He will provide for us what we need if we stay close to Him and do His work well. And to me, that's what I am learning to do through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my job, to carry the message. What message? A spiritual message to the alcoholic who's still suffering. to lead. Now, you know, I don't care how much I memorize this book. I don't care how much I read it, study it, talk about it in meetings, share it from podiums like I'm doing here tonight. So I take what's in here and bring it into my life and live it. It has absolutely no value. It's only words. Only words. And hell, any of us can learn words and we can memorize, you know. So it has to be lived, not just talked. And I know that there's a lot of people, they used to call it two-step, and I don't know what they do anymore. They come in, they get sober, first step, right? First half of the first step, anyway. And then they go to the 12th step, and they're out there, and they're carrying the message. What kind of a message if you carry if you've left out all the in-between, the first and the 12th? You know, and yet I know a lot of people that do this. But anyway, that's beside the point. I know that for me, I have to apply all of this into my life and live it, or it has no value for me whatsoever. So I've got the three essentials, so now I'm on to my fourth step. And taking this inventory, oh God, I was terrified, absolutely terrified. I don't know how you men feel about this, but I was absolutely terrified. I do know how some of the men feel about it because I talked with my husband, and I had the privilege, you know, of talking with a lot of the men that I ordinarily wouldn't have talked to had it not been that my husband was sponsoring. But anyway, it's like, you know, they don't need to do this. You know, they're macho, and they live off of logic. I was like, I was going to open up Pandora's box, and this terrible, ugly thing was going to come crawling out of it when I started this inventory, you know. And hell, you know, when I finally was able to get started, I didn't find anything in there I didn't already know. But I had some secrets that I had not told anybody. Now, in that inventory, it says we're going to do some fact-facing and some fact-finding. We're going to find out some truths about ourselves. And that's the principle that I learned, the principle of truth. So now I've got honesty, open-mindedness, willingness, and I've got truth. And I sat down and I thought, well, where am I having a lot of trouble at? Because first thing I wanted to do was to get a divorce. And my sponsor said, nah, honey. And she said, I don't want you making any major decisions for your first year. And then she turned around and she looked at me and she said, well, honey, I'm going to change that just a little bit. She said, you're sicker than most. I want you to wait 3 years. She really did. And I'm glad that she recognized that because I was, oh, God, was I a sick cookie when I got here to you people. But anyway, so I couldn't get the divorce and I had to wait the 3 years, and my 3 years were up. Now, I'm not advocating divorce by any stretch of the imagination. I have seen some marriages come back together again and just become more loving, more wonderful than they had ever dreamed possible, even when they first got married or before. For me, that wasn't to be the case. And it wasn't only that he was a drunk, it was that he was also a womanizer. And I had gained a little self-respect and self-worth. And it wasn't that I was thinking of myself less. I was just thinking less of myself, you know. I wasn't involved with self all the time is what I'm really trying to tell you. And this self-worth had begun to come into play. And I didn't want to live like that anymore. I felt that I was worth more than that. And so anyway, I ended up getting a divorce. Now, she had also said when she was giving me the rules that she had that I was to live by, she said, and by the way, honey, there is a clubhouse here in the valley, and it's called the Allenest. And she said, I want you to stay away from there, honey, because there's a bunch of dirty old men there helping women with their spiritual program. Well, I had no problem with that because I was married. And when I'm married, I'm married. But when I'm single, that's something else. Well, anyway, I've taken this inventory, and so when I got that divorce, you know where I headed. Right straight over the Allen Nest just as fast as my little legs could take me. I sat there and I looked around. I was just like a little kid in a candy store. I said, I'll have him, 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 and him. Oh, boy. And immediately I knew I was in trouble. Now, oh, boy. What time is it? I can't. Oh, I got it upside down. That's the story of my life. Okay. 8. I'm running out of time. Okay. Because you see, and I hope that what I'm going to talk about here doesn't offend anybody, but I don't think that this is talked about enough in Alcoholics Anonymous now, especially back in California. I don't know what it's like here. Hell yes, I do. People are people. I don't care where you go. But when we get here, and I don't care whether you're 9 or 99, we walk in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous with two problems, bad breath and a broken heart. Booze and sex in plain language, if you will. Okay? And I was in heat again. You laugh. You know what I mean, huh? Anyway, and it scared me. One more time, I was filled with fear because, you see, I was afraid if I got late, I'd get emotionally involved and I'd end up drunk again. And I didn't quite know what to do about it. And I've got these principles now that I'm trying to bring into my life and live. And so I figured, well, I better take another inventory just on my husband's, because I was doing something wrong somewhere and I didn't know what it was, because I was a good wife. I was faithful to my husbands. I never cheated on one of them. I was a good housekeeper. In fact, being a good housekeeper and a good waitress was the only two things I had going for me when I started my first inventory. I kept house real good, and I was a good waitress, and I was a good wife, and I was faithful, and, you know, and I had begun to find out some nice things about myself. But I knew that something was wrong, you know. So, I went back and I took this inventory on the men I had been married to and my life, you know, because I have a book that says, setting aside the wrongs others have done us, wherein have we been wrong? This is our inventories, not theirs. So that tells me that a lot of times they have done me wrong, you know, but I can't think about that because it's my inventory and I have to look at my part in it. You know, what had I done wrong? So this was the inventory I was taking on these three husbands, because I needed to find out, because I'm single again, I'm in heat, and I know I'm going to, you know, get involved somewhere along the line. And so I take this inventory, and what I found was he had charm, polish, and prestige. I think that's befitting of all of us women. We deserve that. He was good-looking, fun-loving, hard-drinking, woman-chasing. Damn, boy, what a challenge, huh? Whee! And I got him, whoever he was at the time, you know. And once we get him, and you guys need to sit back there and laugh, because I've seen you do the same thing. I have had the privilege of holding some of you in my arms, and you have cried over some of these little affairs you were practicing your principles in. So, you know, it happens to you too. And anyway, once we get him, even though they're killing me, you know, I'm not about to let go. Because I know the minute I let go of him, she's going to get him. And when she gets him, he's going to be a sober, faithful, hardworking, you know, I'll just say BS. No go. You know, thank God I was taught, you get what you get when you get it. And that's what you got, you know. And I was taught until I changed, nothing around me would change. If I continued to be the same way, I would continue to be attracted to the same type of a man, and that same type of a man would be attracted to me. Now, as I'm saying, this works both ways, but, you know, I'm talking about myself here. But men do the same thing. And anyway, I didn't know exactly what to do about it, and that was when I got back into the Bible then. And I read that part, and I found a little bit pieces of it in different places in the Bible, where it said, I have created man in my image, and for man I have created woman, and woman is to follow man. And as I told you, look where I was, you know. And so what I did was, I got back into the Bible, and I looked it up. And it did say what I thought it said. It says, I have created man in my image, and for man I have created woman as a helpmate. And woman is to follow man. And then I finished reading it, and it said, and man follows God. And you see, not once had I ever followed a man who followed God. I've already told you what kind of man I followed. So I knew what my problem was. I knew what my problem was, and I knew what I had to do. You know, but it talks about a rebirth, and I don't care what kind of a life you've led out there before coming into A. And I'm talking to the women, when you come in here, you know, we become virgins all over again, believe me. And if you don't believe me, watch these men, watching these newcomer women that come in. They can't wait to be the first one. And they really believe they're going to be the first one. You know, well, they're going to be the first one when the woman gets sober, maybe, you know, but they're sure as heck not going to be the first one, that's for sure. But anyway, you know, I used to think that it was always poor little old Nell who was always the one that was hurt, and that you men always just walked away from these little affairs scot-free, you know, and just on to the next one, you know. And I have found out that that's not necessarily true. I find that you men do cry and that you do hurt the same as we do. And when we women begin to improve our program, it's when we can be as honest and as gentle and as kind with you as we want you to be with us. And when improvement in your program begins to apply is when you begin to want to love the hell out of these women, not the hell that's in them. You know, that's improvement on your program. Anyway, here I am and I'm in heat and I don't know what to do, but by this time I'm picking up some babies of my own. And I'm teaching them the same things I've been taught. But I changed just a little bit. I said, you know, instead of telling you to stay away from the owl nest, I told you, I said, but honey, if you need to get laid, that's all right. Now, what I figured was if they could get laid without getting emotionally involved, they could come back and tell me how, and then I'd be okay, right? I see you agree with me. I'm glad. It made sense, but it doesn't work. Anyway, you know, I got to stop and tell you this little story. And my mama told this to my two brothers when they went into the service, and I figure it applies, oh God, how it applies to our lives. There was this little doggie, and he lived with his family by a railroad track. And he woke up this one morning, it was a beautiful spring day out, and he wanted to go play, so he scratched on the door and let out a yip. And the owner come and let him out, you know, and he ran upon this little hill where this railroad track was close to the house, and he went running along the railroad track, and he was sniffing at the weeds and sniffing at the flowers, and his little ears were just blowing back in the breeze, and he was just having the most wonderful time, and a train come along and cut off a little tiny weeny piece of his tail. Well, now he lit out a yip and he turned around to see what happened to that little tiny piece of tail, and a train come along from the other direction and cut off his head. Now, honey, don't you be like that little dog and lose your head over a little tiny piece of tail, okay? It's what we do, isn't it? You know, I used to laugh at my husband. He said, you know, being an alcoholic and having alcoholism is like making love to a gorilla. You're not finished until the gorilla is through, you know. And that's alcoholism. I like that. But anyway, so here I am, and I'm going to close here in just a minute because I know I have to, I know now what's been wrong, and I know what I need to do. And I had gone into this meeting one day, and at the Owl Nest, I might add, and it was a noon meeting, and my mama and daughter had come up with the word submissive and subservient, and that's how they described me toward the husbands and people in general, but especially toward husbands that I was married to. And so I couldn't wait to get to this meeting the next day to tell everybody what I had discovered about myself, you know. And I got there, and I was talking about it, how submissive and subservient I was. And there was this man sitting in the meeting, and he was drumming on the table, you know, as if he was saying, lady, why don't you shut up? I've got something important to say. You know, have you ever had him do that to you? And I didn't know this man. I had never seen him, and all the time I'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And anyway, when I finished talking, they called on him, and he stood up, and he pointed his finger at me, and he said, lady, he said, did you ever stop to think that all you ever really was just a kiss ass? I didn't even know him. You know, he didn't know me. How dare he? I was so insulted, you know, and I was embarrassed, and I was just everything, and I wanted to walk out of the meeting, and I wasn't getting the satisfaction, and I finally sat through the meeting, and all the way home I cried and cussed and planted and planned and was trying to think up ways to get even with him, you know. And it took me a long time, though, to figure out a way, but finally I did. I married him. So you guys got to be careful, because we women do have a way of getting even. I had the most wonderful 23 years. of my life, I had met a man who followed God. And I never remember a day going by that I didn't tell this man how lucky I was. How lucky I was. And how much I loved him and how much I appreciated him. You know, I didn't know how to say those kind of words before I came into AA. And I'm glad that I was able to do that. You see, I lost him 5 years ago this July. He had cancer. And today, when I get in this self-pity, when I get into this depression, I remember what I was taught in the very beginning. Think of all the things that you have to be grateful for. And you know, I had 23 years of happiness with this man. And it's very hard to be depressed for any long period of time when I have so very much to be grateful for. And I have found it all through you people here, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to tell you what I learned in the fifth step. In that fifth step, it says we have to go to someone. We don't do it from podiums, and we don't go around and telling everybody these inventory secrets that we have kept locked away. We don't tell them all of our dirty stories, you know. But we go to someone, and we tell them all about our life and the thing we have done. And so this woman that I had as a sponsor at that time, she had a big mouth. It was like she couldn't hardly wait to go to the meeting the next day and tell them what I had told her, you know. But I knew I had to, she was the only one I could think of to go to tell this inventory to. And I had something I had never even told a psychiatrist in the 3.5 years I'd been going to him. I mean, this one I had really, you know, kept secret. And I was so ashamed. And anyway, I didn't know what to do about it. So, of course, I had been taught to go into the book, that my answer was in the book. And so I did. I went into the book. And this is what I found that worked for me. It says, cling to the thought that in God's hands, our darkest past is the greatest possession we have. Our darkest past is the greatest possession we have. For it is the key to life and happiness. And with that key, we avert death and misery for others. And this is how I use that. You see, I did not trust her, but I had come to believe in and trust in God. And because of this love and trust of God, I was able to go to this sponsor and tell her all of my life story. And right when I was in the worst part of it, the part that I was the most ashamed of, she started laughing. She said, hell, honey, I done that in spades, you know. And my first thought, being alcoholic, was if she tells on me, I'll tell on her. And when I walked out of there, they talk about a feeling of freedom. I had it because I had uncovered and shared with another human being and God this deep secret that I had kept locked inside of me for so many years. So what I'm telling you is that I had learned the principle of trust, and I immediately then went into my sixth and seventh step, which in the sixth step was entirely ready, you know, to have God remove these. That took a lot of courage to be entirely ready, I'll tell you, on my part. And then in the seventh step, I learned the principle of trust, not of trust, but of faith. Because I had a faith in this power greater than myself. And you know, I want to tell you that coming here into Alcoholics Anonymous, the one thing that I have learned that has helped me the very most here in this program is a little thing in the book that talks about it, and it says, just to the extent that we do as we think God would have us, and then humbly rely upon Him, does He enable us? He does not do it for us. But He enables us to match calamity with serenity, which tells me that there will be calamity in my sobriety. I'm alive. I'm breathing in and out. I'm sober. But I have a new director. And, you know, and I want to wish for all the newcomers and for all of us, really, all the joys, the pains, the frustrations, the angers, the contentment, the peace that I have found here, because this is life, and I have found life right here with you for the first time when I got to you people. And I'll close with this. My life shall touch a dozen lives before this day is through, leave countless marks for good or ill, ere sets the evening sun. This is the wish I always wish the prayer I ever pray, Lord, may my life help other lives it touches along the way. And I thank you.